Hi everyone, it's Lou here. Well, the year is underway and so much is happening as always. Thank you to the wonderful Patreon members who donate a small amount of cash to me each month to help me to keep this podcast going and to engage with the process of advocacy and our common mission to embrace neurodiversity at home, at school, and in the workplace. You can become a Patreon member at patreon.com/squarepegroundhole. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast. Join the private group on Facebook and follow the public page on Facebook. There's also the website. On the website, you can find resources, episodes, news, and advocacy projects. The address for the website is squarepegroundhole.com.au. There's also a profile on Twitter. It's at peghole with, of course, the word hole spelt with a W. I've also got an Instagram page at squarepegroundholepodcast. So there's lots of ways you can contact and engage with the work of this podcast and the work that I'm doing, that we're all doing together. So thank you for listening to my podcast. I hope you find it helpful. Thank you. Wow, I think something happened, and I think it was the Victorian ADHD conference with My Spirited Child. Ash and I spoke at that conference on the 2nd of April, just a few weeks ago, and following that presentation, I've been so lucky and thankful to receive more Patreon members. So I would like to thank today Bernadette, Catherine, Karen, Rebecca, another Rebecca, Alicia, and Sarah. Thank you guys so much. That has been a wonderful surprise and, of course, as always, very much appreciated. I will do everything I can to help you guys. As you know, we've set up the new parent advocacy group in Victoria, so we're going to start things happening there, and I hope that can be my way of repaying your kindness and generosity. And thank you very much for helping me to keep this podcast going. Thank you, everyone. Bye. I would like to acknowledge that this podcast meeting is being held on the traditional lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and pay my respect to elders, both past, present and future, and to welcome you to this new episode for podcast Square Peg Round Hole.
Inside Sprites, we've got news for you. Working together is what we like to do. We are the Inside Sprites. We are the Inside Sprites. Working together is what we like to do. Bridget, Dot, Flynn, Goldie, Jade, Lee, Nico, Bodie. Working together is what we like to do. We build bridges of understanding between
two people. Oh, how gorgeous is that music? We work together. We're just like you. I hope that gives you a bit of an idea of what we're going to talk about today. This is actually the music by Lindsay Munro featuring Raffi, and we're going to hear more about all of that from our wonderful guests for today. So strap in and enjoy another episode of Square Peg Round Hole.
We are just like you.
Welcome to Square Peg Round Hole, the podcast where we discuss diversity and how to embrace our neurodivergent kids at home, at school, and in the workplace. I'm your host, Lou. Today we are talking to Dr. Katrina Martin and Kat Hahai, and they are both speaking to us from Oregon in the USA. It's the first time I've interviewed two guests at the same time. Katrina is the founder of the Bridges Learning System. After years of working within and on behalf of the education system for disabled youth, Katrina believes that true education reform is paramount, and I couldn't agree more with her on that. Kat is a facilitator, educator, and writer. For the last 3 years, she has facilitated rehabilitative programming for incarcerated women, so you can understand why I was so keen to talk to her as well. The Bridges Learning System creates innovative, community-driven educational curricula that empowers autistic and neurodivergent individuals. In their work, the team seek to build bridges that circumvent systemic barriers and societal beliefs surrounding autism and neurodiversity, leading to equity and belonging. They use identity-first language and have values around redefining disability, supporting and collaborating with the neurodivergent community in an environmentally sustainable way and with transparency. So you see why they are with us today. You will hear in my voice during this recording, it's another situation where the joy of finding more neuroaffirming allies was overwhelming. It's just so good to continuously discover these wonderful people. And I know so many kids who would benefit from the Bridges Learning System. So now let's listen to Kat and Katrina. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Katrina Martin and Kat Hahai.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yay, I'm so glad you're here. Now, today is like a big new experience for me. Two people to interview at the same time, which I've not done before. So thank you for both being so patient with me as we move forward. And the second time I've interviewed somebody in the US. So thank you so much for being here on the day before the day that I'm recording. So you're yesterday, aren't you?
Yeah, we're a little bit behind in more ways than one.
Well, we're going to talk about that. So let's start with the icebreaker questions, which I'm going to put to you separately. So let's start with you, Katrina. Can you tell us what your favorite animal is and why?
Well, I had to really think about this because I just really like all animals. But one of them that I really like that's kind of perhaps a little different is the squirrel. I love squirrels. I just think they're so funny and quirky and cute. They remind me a bit of my children. They're kind of energetic and playful and always hanging off of things. And then they also remind me a little bit of myself because they often overthink and overprepare. There's lots of multitasking when you're a squirrel. And so I feel like that kind of represents a lot of my neurodivergence of who I am. And then also, they're just really cute. Like when they eat with their little hands, I mean, adorable. Come on.
They sure are. When we moved to the UK, I just remember we were like videoing squirrels and taking photos of them because we don't have them here. I guess the closest thing we have here are possums.
Oh, wow. So, yeah, they have these cute little fuzzy tails and they communicate in all sorts of really interesting ways. So they have like a verbal communication, but then there's a lot of behavioral communication that they do with their tails and their bodies as well, which I find really fascinating.
Oh, yeah, cool. I love it when people relate it to neurodivergence. It's always good. And what about you, Kat? Do you have a favorite animal?
I do. I did not have to think about this at all. My favorite animal are dogs. Dogs are one of my special interests or passions as a neurodivergent person, and I could probably talk about them for the entire day, much less the entire duration of this podcast. but I actually feel like there's a lot of parallels between animal behavior and human behavior, and also injustices that we've created that humans face and injustices that we've created that animals face. So maybe that's another rabbit hole we can explore at some point.
There's lots of rabbit holes, and we would be here for all of your night if we kept going, I'm sure. I'd love to talk to you for hours. So the next question I have for you is a little bit more serious, and I'll start with you again, Katrina. If there was one thing that you could change in this world, what would it be and why?
Well, I agree with some of your previous guests that this is kind of an unfair question because there's a lot that needs to change in our world. But I'll stick to kind of the topic at hand here. So I think that, you know, as it relates to neurodivergence, the thing that I would love to see change is the assumption that there's such a thing as a person who is normal. Normal is just such a lie. And I think that so much of our world has been really calibrated around this false notion of what normal is and what it means. And really, what is considered normal is simply what's been designed to be accessible and supportive of white, able-bodied, neurotypical men. And if you don't fit this profile, you are really just expected to either change yourself to fit within these expectations or find a way to accommodate your own, quote, difference. So I really think that in order to create an equitable world, we really have to embrace diversity in all aspects of humanity. And in a sense, we have to enlarge the round hole rather than wearing down the edges of the square peg.
Absolutely. I love that. Yes. That poor square peg is getting bashed. So Kat, what about you? What would you like to change in this world?
I mean, everything Katrina said, and also I'm not going to name one thing. I'm going to name a couple things because I can't narrow it down. I'd land back to Indigenous people, reparations to ancestors of enslaved Black people, and I would also take all of the wealth of Jeffrey Bezos and redistribute it among the working class.
Yeah, we have similar situation with the Indigenous and the First Nations people in our country as well. I feel very passionate about that as well and try to be an ally for that. Anyway, we'll keep going and we keep working, moving forward, but I totally hear you. So let's move on to our next question. Again, for you first, Katrina, if that's okay. Can you expand on your story a little bit for us and tell us about your profession, your current role, but also how does it relate to the square peg trying to fit into the round hole?
Well, I think one of the most important aspects of who I am in my profession really comes from who I've been my whole life. So as a neurodivergent person, I personally flew under the radar in school. It wasn't until I was in closer to third grade that anyone actually recognized that I don't read in the same way that everybody else does. But then interestingly, even after I was diagnosed dyslexic, I wasn't given a lot of support from my school because they thought I did just fine without it. And, you know, in one way they were right. I got good grades. I had high comprehension. But what they didn't acknowledge really was just this immense effort that it took for me to keep up with everyone else. And I always find it frustrating that if a disabled person doesn't struggle in a way that society views as valid and that they manage to kind of get by, they aren't given the supports that would really allow them to excel. So in any case, all through primary school, I really kind of made myself small enough to fit through that round hole that was social and academic kind of acceptability. And then when I got to college, I found that that no longer worked, that my self-developed strategies really kind of stopped being effective. And for the first time, I found myself really getting stuck. And I remember this one professor in particular who required us to learn all of the Latin names of all of the plants and animals that were native to the area. And I just couldn't do it. I couldn't say the words, so I couldn't think
the
words.
Surely, who are the people that can do that?
I know, but because I couldn't think them, I couldn't remember them. There just was no way that my brain could hold that information. And I remember going to the professor and trying to explain why this particular task was just so hard for me, and just being met with this kind of concrete stare and total lack of understanding and empathy. And I failed. And I think that experience, along with others of being neurodivergent myself, really kind of pushed me to create this company that we have now. So I'm now the founder of Bridges Learning System, which is just so exciting to even say out loud. And I've really dedicated my life's work and my kids' college funds to create this curriculum that really supports children who don't fit neatly into society's expectations of what they should be or how they should learn. And I really believe that without this curriculum, children who hopefully are using us instead, but if they weren't, they would be in programs where they'd be coerced and manipulated into appearing to be like everyone else at the real risk of losing their authentic selves. So I believe very strongly that diversity is a gift to be cherished and not a malady to be extinguished.
I love that. Oh, I just love it so much. Thank you so much. And thank you for founding what an amazing organization that we're going to talk more about. Thank you. And Kat, what about you? Can you tell us a bit more about yourself and how you got here today?
Yeah, absolutely. My name's Kat. I'm a late diagnosed, multiply neurodivergent person. I'm autistic and ADHD. I'm also multiply disabled. And when I first read this question and knew we were going to be asked this on this podcast, I immediately identified with this metaphor of square peg in a round hole. And it's almost runs parallel to the one that I have often used to describe to people what it's felt like to come into my neurodivergence or understanding of my neurodivergence in adulthood, which is like I felt like I was given the user's manual for a Mac computer, and it turns out I'm using a PC this entire time. And so when I finally got the correct user's manual, it was like, oh, okay, like things are clicking. This is making a lot more sense than what I was working with before.
I love that analogy.
Yeah. And with kind of the idea of a square peg in a round hole, I mean, I feel that in my neurodivergence. I feel that as a queer person too. And I think those are just two examples of so many identities where we're conditioned by the world, either by kind of implied socialization or through explicit socialization and things like social skills training or ABA. We're taught to kind of shape shift. And the world says, I see that you're a square peg. I'd really prefer if you weren't a square peg. So we're going to put an extraordinary amount of time and effort and energy and resources into making you as round as possible. And sometimes you become so round in that process that it almost looks like you fit into that round hole. And then moments of burnout happen, moments of mental health crises. And it kind of reveals the inordinate amount of energy that it takes to make that shape shifting happen. And so, again, I really like this metaphor. I think I'm now in kind of a period of my life where I'm trying to intentionally unmask. I'm trying to embrace the square peg that I am, as opposed to putting so much energy into trying to force myself into the round hole, just because it's so much more sustainable. It's so much better for my mental health, and it's so much better for like the world I'm trying to help create for all of the neurodivergent kids that are coming after me.
Thank you so much for doing that work. And yeah, I'm sure you can imagine that didn't take me long to come up with the idea of the name.
Yep.
it really does feel that way, doesn't it? It's so
Absolutely.
Much about the shape of that peg. And I love the way you're saying you're going back to being more square. and you're very proud, and we want you to be square. We want you to be a square peg. We don't want you to change. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've heard you before. You're wonderful. Way with words. Thank you. So my next question is for Katrina. I have heard, Katrina, that you have been on a journey professionally when it comes to the type of support that you provide to the neurodivergent community. As you know, this podcast is about embracing differences and moving away from behaviorism, as we've just discussed, and towards neurodiversity affirming practices. I understand you have a very important life experience in this regard. You've just told us a bit about that. But can you tell us more about how you moved away from behaviorism and what that felt like, and what led to that? Was there a light bulb moment? Was there something that happened?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, so I've had a lot of formal education. I had a lot of work to undo, but that's jumping ahead a little bit. I think all through my formal education, I was really raised with the sense of the behavioral model being touted as the only real intervention, is the only real hope even for neurodivergent children. And the idea of evidence and research and data were so clearly prioritized. They were just the most important metric of success. And while at times in my education, there were kind of isolated instances of, cries for inclusion, even within these inclusive settings, you know, neurodivergent kids were still being subjected to behaviorist interventions. So I would raise my hand every now and again and say, this is pretty ableist, you guys. Like, don't you think there are different ways that people can express themselves or behave? But it was a hard line. And so, I didn't really see any other options at that point. But that was really my own fault. And it's because I wasn't really looking in the right place. I was looking where I'd been told to look. I'd been looking at research articles. I'd been looking at textbooks and listening to people who were experts. And yet, shamefully, I never really listened to the community. And so finally, a little over a year ago, my husband and I took this trip, just the two of us, got away from the kids and responsibilities. And we sometimes do this and we go out and we dream together of what life could be like. And so we were dreaming and I was talking about, my frustration over the lack of my effectiveness at changing the world from kind of inside the system. And I talked about what I would do differently if I was the one in charge. That's the dream. Everybody, if I was in charge, what would I do differently? And so it was just this kind of basic vacation daydreaming. And that was kind of how it started. So yeah. I've just been incredibly privileged to have the opportunity to make this dream a reality. So I started Bridges in 2021, the very beginning of 2021. It's just been over a year now. And shortly after I started, Kat joined me. And man, talk about a perfect fit. Like, she and I just peanut butter and jelly, I tell you. We work together very, very well. And so, I think the biggest shift at that point was setting aside this notion of expertise. I had to put my pride, my education, all of the research that I'd done, and I had to just move it out of the way so that I could do what should have been done all through my education and all through my research. I had to listen to the lived experiences of the community. And so that's what I did. And that's how I started my journey.
Oh my, Kat's looking at my reactions, I can see. Oh my goodness, seriously. I feel like I'm looking in the mirror in so many ways. You and I are very, very similar. And even that bit where you said you go dreaming with your husband and talk about, I do that with my husband too. We talk, and he says to me, you can't just fix all of this right now, don't you? And, I find that so frustrating. My goodness, that's really blown me away. Sorry. I had no idea it was so similar, and I had no idea it was so recent. I thought you'd been doing this for much longer. Wow. I love you. You're excellent.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it's been a whirlwind for sure. It really has. And, we are just so excited that we have gone from beginning of our company to releasing the curriculum in the amount of time that we have, and have just seen so many people who were waiting for it. They were just waiting for us to create this curriculum, and it's been such a joy.
Oh, I bet. Far out. I'm so excited. Okay, so I'm going to ask the next question now of you again, Katrina. So I don't know if you've listened to this episode, but I hope most listeners will have listened. I interviewed an amazing neurodiversity-affirming occupational therapist. Her name's Carly Coleman, here in Australia, in an earlier episode. And Carly explained concepts of sensory processing, DIR, floor time, and a lot more about the role of neurodiversity affirming occupational therapy. And if you haven't listened to that episode, I encourage listeners to go back and do listen, because she really introduces a lot of these concepts at the beginning. Today, we won't go in over those concepts again because we did that before. But what I really want to know is, what led you to starting the Bridges Learning System? So what is it about the Bridges Learning System that is unique and groundbreaking, Katrina?
Well, I think this is really the first time that a curriculum has been developed from this direction. So our goal was to create a curriculum for autistic and neurodivergent kids created by the autistic and neurodivergent communities. So we wanted to move away from this notion of social skills as though there's one right way to communicate or socialize, and really embrace the idea that there's just so many right ways. Of course, we know that the world is built to accommodate, you know, only certain types of people, only the round pegs. So our curriculum really focuses on changing the environment that children live within by developing more neurodiversity affirming support people. So the SLPs, OTs, mental health practitioners, families, all while at the same time building up children's awareness of their own individual needs and developing self-advocacy skills so that they can get those needs met. So, you know, we take our charge of creating materials that are neurodiversity affirming very, very seriously. Every single detail of our work has been influenced in some way by the community. Our content and teaching strategies came from priorities from the community. The workshops were written by neurodivergent curriculum writers. Even the world that the curriculum takes place within, the world of the insight sprites, was the brainchild of our autistic illustrator. And because of that, because of all of these influences, rather than in spite of them, this is a curriculum that I really believe is groundbreaking and will change the world.
It sounds like it will. I had a good look at it on your website and it looks fascinating. So thank you for explaining that. And what about you, Kat? What drew you to join this team?
Yeah, so I was late diagnosed as neurodivergent in adulthood, not all that long ago. And upon kind of discovering this new piece of myself, and I had previously known about disability justice and kind of had one foot in the disability justice world, but upon kind of discovering my diagnosis, a lot of things fell into place all at once, and a lot of things just started to make sense of in terms of like things I had noticed about myself and things I had noticed in interpersonal interactions in people around me. And so after learning I was neurodivergent, I really wanted to do something related to making the world a better place for neurodivergent people. And two things that were really important to me is I had learned through my own experience kind of the dangers and how easy it is to for neurodivergent people to be socialized to mask. So camouflaging our neurodivergent traits and replacing them with ones that look more neurotypical. So things like, I mean, like I've been standing here this whole conversation, fidgeting and rocking. When I'm masking, I don't do any of those things. I sit completely still and I cannot focus on anything that's going on in the conversation, but I look slightly more neurotypical in those moments.
I'm glad that you feel comfortable enough to just be yourself right now. Fidget away. I don't care
Thank
if you,
you
walk around the room.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that. It does. It really does make it easier when there's explicit permission like that given, just because, yeah, the current is strong and it definitely feels like swimming upstream at some points. But I was aware of the really negative mental health and physical health implications of masking, and knew that that was kind of an important value of mine that I wanted to do something around supporting neurodivergent kids learning that they don't have to mask. And then also a really big thing I've noticed, mostly in people outside of myself who were diagnosed earlier in life, is the presumption of incompetence from people in their lives. So kids who get diagnoses at 3, 4, 5 earlier in life, I mean, there's still so much really bad information about neurodivergence that is unfortunately usually the first that gets shared with caregivers of newly diagnosed kids, that when a parent hears that their 3-year-old was just diagnosed as autistic, the first resource they get is like a handout from Autism Speaks and like your kid needs to go to 40 hours a week of ABA therapy. And now every interaction that that caregiver has is completely 100% shaped by this really limited understanding they have of who their child is and what they're capable of. And so they start treating their child and assuming, oh, you're not absorbing the things that are happening in this conversation. Those things are going over your head. You're not capable of enough to go to college, so we're not going to worry about taking steps forward in the college application process, or it's not possible for you to maintain a job, so we're not going to work on anything to work on job skills or get you started with an application process. And I mean, that has obviously many material negative impacts, but also the internalized ableism that occurs when a child who then turns into an adult, if they're lucky, they turn into an adult, when they've heard all of those messages again and again and again from parents, from teachers, from doctors, from therapists their entire life, they've then internalized this message of, oh, I'm not good enough, I'm incapable, I'm incompetent because I'm neurodivergent. And that had, I'd seen a lot of that going on in my life growing up, and it never fully sat right with me, and I never really had the language to explain why until getting older and kind of gaining some disability justice vocabulary and also learning about my own neurodivergence. And so those two pieces, like wanting to create safety to unmask and wanting to create a world where we always presume competence, those were two really important kind of values of mine and things in the back of my head. So it's my really long-winded explanation.
Oh, thank you. It's that pathway of the starting with the ABA and trying to fix the child, and it's all so deficit-based and impairment-based and just awful. It's awful, but it's still happening. And you know, that is exactly what's still happening here. And the alternative to that is still very slow to take off, and that's why I'm here, to get that message that you just so brilliantly articulated out to as many people as possible, especially those young parents who need to hear that, what you just said. So thank you for saying it. Really appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you for making a space for me to say it.
Oh, you've always got a space with me, trust me. Thank you so much. The next question I have is for Katrina, but feel free to both answer. It's absolutely fine. What is the neurodiversity affirming curriculum, Katrina, that you provide? And the C, I noticed you've got this C bridge system. And how can Australian therapists and parents access or interact with it? Do you have many Australians involved already?
We are so excited to say yes, we do. We probably have almost as many Australians as we do people from all other countries combined, including the US. We have had a huge uptake by Australians, and it's been so wonderful to hear. And I think that's why, you know, Kat was mentioning before this, I think it's amazing that, you know, Australians seem really ready for this, really ready to take that step towards being neurodiversity affirming, and how wonderful that is. I think here in the States, it's been a little bit slower, but, you know, we're making our way. So I'll tell you a little about the curriculum itself. So our flagship program is called the C-Bridge. It stands for Social Emotional Acuity Bridge. And it's a series of workshops. So we have 41-hour workshops, and they're used about once a week with autistic and neurodivergent kids, either individually, like in one-on-one sessions, or in a group setting. And each week, there's a different topic that children explore. We've mentioned some of them already, but others are, you know, different styles of communication, embodied emotions, authentic social connection. So we're covering some of the same topics as you might hear about in like a social skills program, but we are not a social skills program. Because as we're talking about these different concepts, we're not teaching that this is the way you need to communicate. We're not placing value on one form of communication over another, or one form of socialization over another. Instead, we really validate different ways of interacting and communicating. And then we teach both the children and the adults how to build these bridges when you have a different style. So building bridges across neurotype, we recognize that the double empathy perspective is real, that often autistic folks really understand autistic folks, but better than a neurotypical person might understand that autistic person. So really a lot of the work that we do is on trying to build this understanding across two neurotypes. So the workshops really themselves take place in this really beautiful imaginative place. It's the world of the insight sprites. And it's really fun and engaging for kids, which is, I think, a big part of its success, honestly. Like, this is not some dry, boring, even replacement for flashcards. This is really, you know, bringing kids into this world that's a lot of fun and where they can really see themselves. So we take kids through activities that take place in the world of the insight sprites. We have activities like choose your own adventure stories, puppet shows, videos. And the world of the insight sprites is really familiar, but also just different enough to be really fascinating and interesting. So for example, the insight sprites go to school in a log that's a fallen log in the forest. And so it gives you this impression that this world is just beneath your feet somewhere. And we have been so incredibly fortunate to have our insight sprite architect, who is also our illustrator and is brilliant creator, come up with all of these amazing and imaginative characteristics of the world and the sprites themselves. And so it allows kids to really find themselves, not because of the skin color or the gender of the sprites, but because of who they actually are. And I think this is really key to kids being able to identify, you know, what their own needs really are, because they don't have to say, oh, you know, I really need to spin in order to feel comfortable. Instead, they can see our character Dot spinning in one of the activities and say, oh, I do that too. And so it takes the pressure off. There's not this, like, you know, looking at the child and saying, okay, what's different about you? What is it specifically that you need? Instead, there's this lovely way to kind of relate to something that is completely normalized within this world of the insight sprites. So they go through these different activities, and then they're led by the SLP, OT, or mental health practitioner through a series of discussion questions. So we start in this really safe space that's familiar but different. And then we move to discussion where we go back into our own world. And we talk about how these concepts really relate to our classroom and our community. And then we have a follow-up activity that kids do at home with their caregivers, where they really dive deep into how does this concept relate to me as a person. And so it's just this really beautiful, I call it a learning arc, where you have this nice flow of engaging, fun content that allows kids to really connect with it from a safe space all the way to how it's meaningful to me as an individual. And so that's what the SeaBridge is. Obviously, I have a lot of love for this curriculum. It's been created over the past year. It's taken a while, but we are really, really excited about how it's come together. And right now, we're selling it really to SLPs, OTs, and mental health practitioners, families and caregivers that are interested in using it, we encourage to find, you know, a provider who is using it. It's really, I think, helpful to have somebody who can facilitate these types of conversations amongst groups of neurodivergent kids. Because really, when you're talking about concepts of neurodiversity, it is really helpful to have more than one person present. It's helpful to understand diversity as it's really situated within a community. So that's what the C-Bridge is. It's available online, which is how we've gotten so much interest from Australia, and can be delivered either remotely or in person.
Okay, I was going to ask you some, you've answered some of the questions that were in my head at the end there. Is there any particular age that the kids need to be, or?
Yeah, so we've designed it for kids age 5 to 10. That said, it's that the content is really appropriate for all people. You know, I think these ideas of learning to identify and validate your own needs, come up with boundaries and express those boundaries to other people, super pertinent for middle school and high school age kids as well, where we really see kind of the a little bit of the miss for kids that are much older is with the characters themselves. So the Insight Sprite characters are all designed to kind of resemble elementary age kids. They also, you know, we know a lot of adults who really like Pokemon and My Little Pony. And so if you have a group that really, you know, enjoys cartoons and things like that, then it may not be a problem at all. So we do have a demo. We encourage anybody who's interested to check out the demo. And that allows you to really think about it, you know, press the different buttons, see what happens, and think about it with your particular group of kids in mind.
Yeah. Okay, great. Yeah. I'll link all of those things, the demo. I think that's on your website, isn't it? And I'm just thinking about people who are listening here in Australia, and you've explained how they can interact with it. It's an online program. What about teachers? Is this something that you, because I have a lot of teachers that listen, I think, here in Australia. What do you think their role would be? Would it be something they could recommend to the families of students that they have and that kind of thing?
Yeah, definitely. I also think there is a place for this in schools. You know, ultimately, we hope that our classroom will be in like a public school system where neurodivergent, neurotypical kids are sitting side by side learning the same thing, learning the different ways of communicating are all valid. I mean, how important is it? You know, it's so important for neurotypical kids to really hear these messages as well. So I do think that there is a place in the classroom, you know, for this curriculum and certainly for this content and this message. And really, you know, it's about kind of developing an appreciation of diversity as opposed to exclusion or even tolerance of diversity. We really want an appreciation because it is, you know, all of the different ways of thinking, of being, of communicating that make up a community really add value to it.
Well, I think this adds something to my armamentarium when I'm advocating with education departments here in Australia. Often we're saying we don't want you to do these behaviorist sort of approaches of the carrot and stick, and the rewards and sanctions and those things are not working for, we argue, all students based on what we've been learning from experts like Dr. Mona Delahook and Dr. Ross Green. But this offers a solution to that will benefit everybody and provide that connection and insight that you're saying. So thank you again. I'm going to explore this further. They're going to be sorry when I get onto something. They sort of go, oh, here she goes. But this will be really good to add. So thank you. It sounds fascinating and wonderful. I wish it was around when my son was younger. Is there anything else, Katrina, that you would like to say that is on offer from the Bridges Learning system in general that people here in Australia might not know or might need to know before we move on to the next section?
We also, we do have blogs and free resources. With the blogs, we do a lot of kind of talking about moving away from ABA, becoming more neurodiversity affirming. And then we have invited guests who are neurodivergent write blogs for us. So that's that. And then we have some free resources on our website as well.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for that. I will make sure that I connect your website to this episode, and I have a Facebook group where I can share some of those resources and lead people to those blogs, which will be very interesting to read. Thank you. And Kat, what else were you going to say?
I just wanted to add that what's turned into one of my favorite parts of the Seabridge curriculum is actually not for the kids, it's for the families. It's a component that we're calling Nurturing Neurodiversity, and it's a 2 to 3 page handout that gets sent home with families along with every 2 workshops. So there's 20 throughout the whole program. And it's basically kind of a download of the topics that are being taught in workshops, but for parents. And then kind of more information and links to other resources where if they really identify with something, or they're like, wow, that's my kid to a T, there's resources where they can kind of explore that further. So things like, I mean, one of the really early ones is about the workshop titled Being Together, Being Me, which is one of the workshops where that really establishes like, there's no one way to listen. There's no one way to communicate. There's no one way to play. There's lots of different things. There's lots of diversity within each of those kind of ways of being around other people, and all of them are equally valid. And so kind of part of the Nurturing Neurodiversity for like that specific workshop is educating families of like, did you know that listening can look more than one way? And that for a lot of neurodivergent folks, like maintaining constant eye contact or focusing on doing like the perfect amount of eye contact and then the subtle look away and then the look back, that actually distracts from listening and leads to that person doing a worse job of paying attention. And so maybe your kid is like me and they look into space while they're talking to other people and they rock while they talk or they rock while they listen. But just kind of extending the learning from the classroom to the home so that the child is really being supported in all areas of their life in being able to unmask and kind of be their authentic selves and be as supported as they can as a neurodivergent human.
That's such a good point. And I was thinking that while you were talking, sometimes one parent one parent's sort of ahead on the journey and another one has not yet realized and caught up. And it's so important for even siblings, let's not even start that conversation. other members of the family, you're right. Not everybody's at the same stage and has the same level of understanding. So that's a really good point. It's something that might be basic to the mum. The dad might not have realized things like eye contact, of course. So important to go over that again. Okay, let's move on. I want to talk about now, if we can, behavior as it applies to children that you work with, Kat. What do you want parents and teachers to know about behavior and neurodivergent children?
Ooh, I have so many thoughts about behavior and neurodivergent children, and I will keep them relatively brief. when I think of behavior, which is a really loaded word, I think of kind of 2 categories just for the sake of this conversation. I think of behavior that's sort of benign in its impact on other people, and it can actually be like really positive in its impact on yourself. So when I say that, I mean things like stimming, like that does not really have a negative impact on the people around you. And if you claim that it has a negative impact on you as the person watching someone stim, that's your own ableism that you need to unpack. It's actually not that person's job to stop stimming in front of you. So things like stimming, like monotropism, only focusing on interests or topics that you're really passionate about, as opposed to like really like small talk or moving from one topic to the next, or not following neurotypical social conventions. So like not making eye contact, none of those things really negatively impact other people. And so for those kinds of behaviors, I think it's a really like stay in your lane moment for neurotypicals and kind of an opportunity to evaluate, does this actually affect me, or am I just uncomfortable by, am I made uncomfortable by disabled people because of my own ableism? And then in addition to these kind of benign behaviors that can actually be really positively impactful for the neurodivergent person, there's also those behaviors that are harmful to self or others, which are, I think, often only looked at a really surface level and are not fully understood by people outside of the neurodivergent person. And I am actually going to make a dog analogy here. So I'm really interested in animal behavior and specifically like dog body language. That's a thing I nerd out about on my free time. And like a really common thing in the culture of dog ownership, at least like in the United States, I don't know if this is true universally, but dog ownership is super common. A lot of people have dogs, and very few people understand how to read dog body language. And there's also really specific expectations that people have about how their dogs are supposed to interact with other dogs, with the world, with stimuli, with people that think they're cute and fluffy and want to come pet them. And dogs are very communicative animals. They will let you know when they're not okay with a situation. And so when you take your rescue puppy to a highly stimulating dog park and you introduce it to like the Australian Shepherd that's pulling on their owner's leash because they're so excited to meet this other dog, and your new rescue dog starts fear licking or whale eyeing or turning their head to the side, like however that animal communicates, like, hey mom, I'm kind of scared right now, could we maybe leave this situation? If you as the dog owner miss those behaviors, that dog is going to learn then, okay, cool, this person who's supposed to advocate for me in these moments and not put me in situations that are not okay with me, I'm going to have to advocate for myself. And the ways that dogs advocate for themselves is escalating to louder and louder behaviors until whatever the thing is, the dog or the person or the stimuli that's making them uncomfortable. And so after a dog has learned my human's not going to advocate for me, I need to advocate for myself, the next time the dog sees another dog on a walk that they don't want to say hi to, they might escalate to snapping or they might escalate to biting. And in that moment, all the humans outside of the dog in that interaction say like, wow, what a bad dog. They're really poorly trained. They have really badly behavior. And there's very little acknowledgement of what was happening in the environment and in the people whose job it was to set that animal up for success. There's very little acknowledgement of all the factors that went in to lead that dog to make a choice that is actually super reasonable, given the context that they're being continually put in situations where their no isn't being listened to. And so they have to be louder and louder and louder to get their needs met. And so, okay, circling back to the human world, I mean, the exact same thing happens every single day in the human world when our kids are communicating to us all the time, and that communication is not always understood. And there are dire costs when we miss that communication. And so when there's harmful behaviors, either to self or others in like a classroom, for example, yes, we want to avoid that behavior happening. And we can't just look at that moment. We need to understand, how have we failed to set this person up for success in getting their needs met, in listening to their no, in respecting their no, and putting them in a situation where they have a choice to like show up in the ways they want to rather than being forced into showing up in that way. So I guess where I'm going with that is with behavior, I think there's a real need to kind of reevaluate where and why we're placing responsibility and really moving responsibility from neurodivergent people in moments of crisis to the people around that person who are supposed to support them, and saying like, how can we change this context to better fit this person's needs?
Okay. Yeah. It's interesting you use that dog analogy because we have a dog here and she is super anxious and has, when I know a lot of people say their dog is anxious, but our dog, everything you said, whale eye, that head down, it's that the body language we have learnt so much about, which has been so good for our family to work on that work. That analogy actually describes a lot of our life, our everyday life with our dog, because we are often doing that with her and say, no, she's guarding that, or no, she doesn't understand what's happening right now. And you can see her behavior change. So I do, I relate to that a lot. And you're right. That is very similar to what happens to neurodivergent, particularly students at school experiencing that ableism where the responsible adult with them may not be recognizing what's going on for them. And they'll often say, there was no trigger. I don't know. They just suddenly did something because they've not picked up on what's really going on for them. So, yeah. I now want to ask you, Kat, a little bit more about the intersectionality of neurodivergent youth and the criminal justice system, as I believe you have some experience in that area, and quite a few of my listeners have asked me to investigate this further. I've not yet found the right person, so maybe this could also be another episode. But if you could briefly let us know about your experiences in that area of, you know, the connection between neurodivergent youth and the criminal justice system.
Yeah, absolutely. This is also a question I could spend a very long time going down many rabbit holes about. And my one preface is like, I am not a currently or formerly incarcerated person. And like the most expert people to talk about this are people who are, have been incarcerated. So that's my disclaimer, outside perspective. but my experience that I do have, my background is in social work, and the position I was in actually before coming to Bridges was doing social work in a prison setting. And through that experience, I learned a lot about kind of the intersections between neurodivergence and the criminal justice system. And I mean, the number one thing I think of is how overrepresented neurodivergent people are in the prison system. And not just, I mean, yes, in the numbers that we do know and that we do have, and I would argue the numbers are actually way higher than we know of because of how many people are undiagnosed or were misdiagnosed. And I mean, lack of diagnosis and lack of adequate supports is absolutely a factor in what led those folks to be criminalized in their youth and then criminalized in adulthood for many of those same things and to involvement in the criminal justice system. And also acknowledging that people who are neurodivergent while Black or autistic while Black face a really specific kind of criminalization for their race and for their disability compared to like a white neurodivergent person or a white autistic person. And something else I'm really interested in kind of at these intersections is the parallels of behaviorism in the prison system and in our education system and in like quote unquote therapy practices. And so the same exact behaviorism that exists in schools and in ABA and all of those programs, it exists in the prison system, but kind of like tenfold or a hundredfold. The entire system is built off of what's desirable behavior and what's undesirable behavior, which is sometimes related to let's reduce harm that's being done to human beings. And sometimes it's related to like what's an arbitrary standard that we've come up with for what we like and what we don't like. And there's a whole bunch of rewards and punishments that get used to reinforce those desirable behaviors and weed out the undesirable ones. And I say that it's the same behaviorism, but tenfold or a hundredfold because of how high the stakes are in that kind of a setting. I mean, the rewards and punishments are things like, are you going to release on the day when you're actually supposed to release, or are we going to take good time away from you and you're going to get back to your families later than you expected? Or are you going to get to be housed in general population and like have human interaction other than just with officers? Or are you going to be housed in segregation? Or are you going to have restricted visits where you can't hold your two-year-old kid on your lap. You have to visit with them through the glass and explain to them why mom can't come out to the visiting room. We can't hug today. And so, yeah, it's just a really, I mean, there's this quote, which I don't remember who it's by in this moment, but we can judge a society by the state of its prisons. And I think prisons are such a kind of poignant and concentrated example of everything that's wrong in society at all levels and kind of from all perspectives. And I think behaviorism and how that relates to disability and race and gender and motherhood, we really see all of those things coming to a head in our prison system.
Yeah, it's really sad and really, really concerning. I mean, we think it's tough enough on the outside, but that's why I think a lot of my listeners have asked about exploring this further because of just the general concerns, but youth who have had some experience with maybe being arrested for something or, you know, spending just even a couple of nights locked up, you know, what they've experienced and what they've expressed is that even though the people looking after them, what do we call the officers, the correction service people, would be aware that they may be autistic or neurodivergent in some way, that doesn't change anything about the way they are experiencing that interaction at that time. So I know it's a bigger question and we can't go talking about it for too long here today, but I'm very interested to talk about that further in the future because parents want to know what they can do about that. And then as you mentioned, there's also this what we call in Australia the school to prison pipeline that a lot of our young people experience. You've probably got a similar terminology for it, which is just awful, but that is what's happening. So we do need to address it and see what we can do as allies and people caring for others to try and make some improvements or something. I don't know, advocate and try and help. Just to finish us off now, we're getting towards the end. Katrina, is there anything else that you would like people to know or that is important to you that you would like to communicate now?
I think one of the things that we believe strongly as a company is that the path to becoming neurodiversity affirming is a journey, not a destination. And you won't get it right all of the time, which I think can be really hard for people who perceive themselves as experts or parents. You know, I definitely fall into both of those categories as, you know, having a hard time sometimes giving myself the grace. But you have to keep listening and keep learning. One of our values at Bridges is that we don't yet know what we don't yet know. And so we realize that we have to keep learning. We have to keep an open mind and continue to enact what we learn and what we hear from the communities that we serve.
I agree with that too. Of course, we're never really there and it's hard. It's still really hard. So we need to acknowledge that totally. Yeah, thank you. And just to finish the episode, Kat, I was just wondering if you could tell us, do you have any mentors or books or resources that you'd like to share with us? You've been such an absolute wealth of knowledge and amazement today and I can't wait to hear what really drives you and what matters to you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Katrina and I have come across such an amazing laundry list of resources in creating this curriculum, and we have quite a few that we want to just name and shout out if they're of interest to anyone else listening today. And the sort of preface to all of this is that we recommend listening to autistic and neurodivergent voices first if it's anything surrounding or adjacent to the neurodiversity community. Tara Vance, the CEO of Neuroclastic, is phenomenal. They've written a handful of articles for the Neuroclastic website that we absolutely adore and have been really foundational actually in some of the workshops that we've created for our curriculum. Articles that we want to shout out right now are parts 1 and 2 of the Weaver and Concluder theory, series, there we go, the Identity Theory of Autism, and Very Grand Emotions. There's also a handful of social media accounts, kind of going back to this idea of many ways of knowing, and academia is not the only form of expertise. We do a lot of learning from real people living their lives and sharing that experience and information with the world. Two that we wanted to call out are Tiffany from Fidgets and Fries on Instagram and Facebook, and the Justice for Matthew Russian Instagram and Facebook pages. And that page is focused mostly on advocacy for Matthew Russian, the Black autistic man who was wrongfully incarcerated a few years ago. And then an activist and author that I personally really love and has really shaped my understanding of disability justice is Mia Mingus. Her blog, Leaving Evidence, is phenomenal. And specifically the post on the medical industrial complex is like one that I recommend reading about 17 times and giving yourself like a month long break in between all of the reads because you need to digest it. And then kind of circling back to the conversation about behavior and my very long dog tangent that I went on, the Sources of Aggression checklist from We Are Like Your Children is a really, really helpful resource that was written by autistic adults as kind of a beginning guideline to help, I mean, mostly parents, but it could be like educators also, for trying to identify the source that's leading kids to act in aggressive ways. So are there sensory needs that aren't being met? Are there physical needs or medical needs that aren't being met? So we highly recommend that resource. OTs for Neurodiversity on Instagram, Facebook, and Teachers Pay Teachers. They have awesome classroom and clinician materials that are neurodiversity affirming. And then CEUs through Learn, Play, Thrive for any practicing clinicians. And then finally, Rachel Dorsey on all social media platforms. And then she also has a course on Learn, Play, Thrive. So that's our very long list.
It's wonderful though. And I'm so lucky I've got this amazing website where I can link all these resources to each episode and then people just click on it and then there it is. So, and I'll be obviously putting those, you know, mentioning those links as well. What do I say? Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Both of you. You're amazing. Both of you. It's been wonderful. I had no idea, really, it was going to be so good. So thank you.
Thank you so much, Lou. We really, really appreciate the opportunity to talk to all the people in Australia. Like, what a cool opportunity for us.
Yeah, thank you. Aussies, well, we'll be very keen to hear from you. There's a lot of very desperate parents and teachers as well. It's a real I mean, I know we've talked about this, but there's a real education crisis, I think, happening everywhere, really. So the teachers are desperate for some assistance, and a lot of those resources you've mentioned and your wonderful articulation of the issues will help them. And that's really all that matters, isn't it? We just want to help. So thank you both. All right, well, I'll sign us off now. The music will start soon and we can say goodbye. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Lou.
Acknowledgements. Thank you to Carla Cushell of Carla Cushell Creative for the podcast logo and the website. Editing by Matt Cushell. Images and episode quotes are the work of Jazzy C. Music is also by Jazzy C. Finally, a big thank you to my friends and family for encouraging me. As always, thank you to my partner in everything, Ash Cushell. And remember, just be nice to one another.